very pleased indeed again to welcome Professor Billy Morio to give his second session of the Shiv Dasani Fellowship and the first seminar of the Shiv Dasani seminars.
Right.
And he's going to draw on his expertise in his previous publications on the diaspora, Hindu diaspora, and speak to us today on Hinduism's transnational diasporias, a view from Oceania.
Yes.
It's a wonderful title, and I'm looking very much forward to hearing that.
Thank you. All right. Well, this is from a huge, it's a huge project, and it's been an ongoing. Something I started way back, I can't even remember. Someone had asked me to write something on Indians in Victoria. That's where it started. And then it sort of grown into Hindus in Australia, or Hinduism in Australia. That was the first book. And then the government got interested, the multicultural department, and they asked me to do another edition a few years later. But they wanted Sikh community added to it as well, so it becomes Hindus and Sikhs in Australia, which in some ways is good because it's sort of representative of South Asian religious diaspora rather than just Hindus. And we are here and there. We have some comments on Parsis as well as Indian Muslims to some extent, and also, of course, the sort of new religious movements as well. But let me start with a little bit towards the history. It's got fascinating history, actually, of Indian migration to Australia. And now, of course, it's become much more of a global phenomenon with a sort of transnational commute as well between people in Melbourne, which is a kind of southern Silicon Valley, Sydney and Melbourne, and California, the Silicon Valley there. So, you know, you get sort of a conduit now between Melbourne, Singapore, Bangalore, Hyderabad, and the Silicon Valley. So there's quite a lot of movement that goes on, which is not the sort of thing that ever happened before. There was really historically not much connection between Indians in Australia and Indians in the US, say, for example. There was always connection with Southeast Asia, especially Malaysia, and Singapore being part of that now, or recently broken away, of course. And of course, the other areas like New Zealand and Fiji Islands and some of the other Pacific Islands where Indians have ended up. So that was sort of really the world. And Gandhi was very aware of that. So he sent C.F. Andrews at one time, and another man, Manilal Parikh, and a sadhu, just Totaram Sanadhye, was a Hindi writer, as his ambassadors to sort of stir up a little bit of a nationalist movement in that part of the world as well, especially the sort of free coolie laborers who were suffering the same kind of hardship in these places as they were in Natal in South Africa, where Gandhi worked. Okay, so coming back, it's sort of the period, talking about South Africa on Natal especially, there is a convergence of the sort of period, because it all has to do with post-slavery import by the colonies of cheap labor, basically indentured laborers. And that's how Indians end up, at least in the islands, the Fiji Islands, just as they end up in Caribbeans and Tobago and Trinidad was what I was thinking of. Now, there were no signs of indentured laborers as such in Australia, which was a slightly later development. But there were, from very early on, with the first fleets that came to Australia, there were crews on board the fleets that brought settlers and penal convicts to Australia from here, from Ireland, Wales, and so on. So there were cooks and so forth, and they got off, some of them stayed on. But one of the great attractions of the South Asians in, especially from Afghanistan area, were these camelias, the camel drivers. So they're Afghans, so they're called Ghans. Now there is a big train that runs right across the continent called Gans, after the Afghans. And they were, in a way, quote-unquote Hindus, because they came on Indian national, which really means British colonial, issued papers, because there was no other office where they were being offered. There was no, I don't think Kabul was ever quite active in this way, or if it was, it wasn't close enough to the water, to the sea, for them to jump on boats. And of course the camels were, I think it was probably Karachi or somewhere that they would board. So that was also, you know, it was basically British India. And then there were some laborers that started to come a little later on as well, because they needed them as farmhands. And so that was the indentured part. Indentured, all that means is that they were given a passage, and then they would be sent back again. They would be recalled back to their country after the contract was over, which is of course something that Gandhi was fighting to try and sort of keep people there rather than have them as temporary laborers. But only men came, no women came. So for about 100 years, they were not allowed to bring their wives or children and so on, which is very difficult. And some of these coolies or cameleers married into the Aboriginal families. So you know, you have sort of a famous footballer who's half Aboriginal, and his name is Khan. I wonder where the Khan comes from. Of course, it comes from having married three generations down the line. But a lot of them went back. I mean, that was the deal. Some stayed on, and much later on, they started, the Sikhs in particular, started sugarcane plantation and banana plantations. And they established what would effectively be the first South Asian temple in Australia. Was really a gurudwara. And that goes back to about the early 1930s, roughly speaking. Now, there was this all this sort of theory stuff, which I think I'm going to skip. I don't know how to operate this, by the way.
Just press the arrow next to it.
Okay. Of course, one thing to mention is that there was a period, for a long period. Okay, let me rephrase this, and I wonder if I can sort of intersperse this with some images as well. But how would I do that? I'd have to come out, wouldn't I?
On that drive.
Yeah. It'd be nice to have some images at the same time too. So can we go back and forth, or? Well, for the time being, maybe just show me this image here, and if you could have it on the background, that would be really great. Yeah.
This one.
Yeah, but can you pull up the other slide? Yeah. So there was a period. So there was a period when the coolie laborers arrived, the camel drivers arrived, some of them stayed back, some of them managed to get, yes, if you open that,
pictures?
The most recent one, which is the most 31st, yes, that's the one, yes. Right. So some of them who stayed back managed to get license, and were given licenses, or what they call, I guess, permit to operate as hawkers or peddlers, as they would probably be also called. So now here we are. Here this is the first, one of the earliest images that we have of Sardarjis or Pathans. They also came from Balochistan. So they're sort of a mix of Hindu Punjabi, Hindu Muslim, Hindu Sikh, and Balochistanis. And this is sort of very early, 1905. You can see they're cooking a meal But what's striking is that most of them still wear ties on. You know, so good tradition. So in their honor, I put a tie on as well. But yeah, right, yes. So it's of course the archetypical British requirement that everyone wears ties. The Bimal Matilal's son, Tamal. I've never seen him without a tie. Luka Singh, is very interesting, an Indian hawker in his wagon. And we've now recently discovered sort of graveyards and so forth, way in very traditional, remote areas. I think that Luka Singh himself, we've found his, this is why PCs should be banned. This is go for Mac. Because it does all kinds of strange things. There were either farmers, or later on they would use their cart. And I think this man is probably a hawker. Yes, he is a hawker. So they hawked silkware, utensils, whatever they could get hold of. Either they came from India or locally produced. But they went to very remote areas, actually. And very dangerous, too, because this was a time of White Australia policy, and some of them were beaten and sent away, but there was also a good relationship with lots of locals. So here's another one with his horse and caravan, and some of these caravans are actually preserved. Then civilization arrives down under, and then a lot of other things will happen in a moment on the streets and so on. So can I get back to the text somehow? Right. So we'll come back to. So the picture that you had, yeah. So look, if you had Mac, it would be so much simpler. So now you have. So in this book, we present a historical analysis. This one here. Okay. So here's the. So I'll skip this theory part. So this is where I was. One thing to remember is that the distance, and because of the White Australia policy, almost meant that this group would go almost extinct, and they did. There's not many from this period survived, and then it declined when Australia federated. When all these were separate colonies, what are now states, they became federated under one Australian nation, and they adopted the White Australia policy, which was a way of keeping out immigrants, people of color, and so on. But still, some people came in. There's a Sindhi family called Pavamuls. They came in as mine diggers, digging mines and so on. Later on, became very, very well-established opal traders, and they're still around it by the fourth, fifth generation, and one of the big supporters of the Hare Krishna movement there in Australia. Also, you know, the Hindu welfare groups as well. And of course, the distance in those days. Of course, it probably took about 4 or 5 months for a boat to actually travel out. So of course, when the economy started to grow, the people were in greater demand because they had certain other things that they could bring other than just labor. You know, laboring skills. They became high tech. They became professionals. They were doctors, and this was a period in about. Almost the same time as in the U.S., about 1965 and so on, immigration policies changed, they opened up. And, of course, you know, you either go chalo chalo America or nahita Australia. Ek hi gor aur kaale log ke desh. It's the same white and black country. A trade between Australian colonies and British commence records of arrival of... Okay, so we've covered the Balochistanis and so on. So here we are. I mean, there's very... Good images. Here's it's the women who usually, you know, would buy the wares and so on, but the men would, you know, chase them out, and they had fights among themselves. You know, the Hindus wouldn't eat with the Muslims because they, you know, they were cooking either beef or something, there were reports that these people were very indulgent. They spent a lot of time smoking either ganja or hookah, and they were niggardly with their money and so forth. Well, they were actually saving money to send money back to their homes in Punjab, wherever. Now, between the two world wars, trickle of migration, camel drivers mostly, Afghans, hawkers arrived. It was a bit like the sort of Rama's banishment, spouses left behind. Resident Indians agitated for rights. Enter mid-1920s, Srinivas Shastri. He was a prominent delegate to the Imperial Conference in Durban. And he fought for the rights. And in fact, what's interesting is that the Indians were given entitlement to property, license, their own business, limited voting franchise, ahead of other immigrant groups, including Chinese and Jews, because they were British subjects of sorts. The stage one is phrased into the stage two. So the first one, as we saw, was the camel drivers and farmhand people. In the second stage, you have much more sort of diplomatic visits and so on, but also the agitations, the anti-colonial agitations in the mainland. Not so much when it was happening in Africa. It seems like as if that didn't have much of an impact as it did in the U.S. with the African Americans. But it was much sort of later, a little later, when Gandhi got back to India, that his emissaries like C.F. Andrews, Manila Parekh, Tottaram, arrived and started to express concerns about the plight of the indigenous people. This is a much later follow-up after the sort of professional people have arrived, and Indians have got a little bit more rights than most of the other people, and they're pretty well established. And then the White Australia policy is disbanded about mid-1970s, partly because there's economic reasons, populated Paris, the onset of Cold War, because a lot of the younger people were lost in the wars, so they had to populate. But most of the preferred immigrants came from Greece, Middle East, and so forth. Not so much Middle East, Greek, Mediterranean, and of course Britain and Ireland. But of course they took a lot of the Jewish refugees as well from the war, from the wars. But they all didn't have any kind of professional qualifications, so, whereas India was now beginning to produce engineers, doctors, and so on. So that's when our population started to grow again. But there were other social and demographic factors that were against them. There was an assimilationist policy. Cultures weren't going to survive if they came for a long time. There was really almost no incentive, as there wasn't even in the States as well. I'm leaving out Britain because Britain is slightly different sort of a situation. In the States also, from about the mid-1960s to about mid-1970s, there was really no incentive to retain one's own culture, religious practices, and so on. People wanted to be as quickly as possible integrate, become Americans, really, and in Australia become Australians. In America, it was expected that you become American. In Australia, it wasn't sort of quite expected that you become Australian, because only whites can be Australians, right? But somehow you discard your baggage and your wares. What you become is almost an oblivious, a person. I don't know if you read something with Rahul Mehta. It was posted on the Risa that he hated going to the Vrindavan, the one in Virginia, and so on, and just mumbled away. And why couldn't they go play baseball and so on? But the parents were quite sort of integrated. Not so integrated into the American society, but still retaining Indian culture and so on. It was much later that we realized that, of course, that was all because of the pressure of the melting pot, assimilationism, and so on and so forth. But then, on the other hand, there are people. One of our students, that I won't name, happens not to have an Indian name, and I ask, how come? And she said, well, my parents just wanted us to be all Americans, and everything is all American. They even changed the Brahmin, good Southern Brahmin name, changed the spelling, not so much. Because, of course, when you go to India, you want to be recognized as, of that caste, but not certainly not in America. And that was very, 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 that was a sort of practice almost right across the Anglo-Celtic Protestant societies. So anyway, now things change. After mid-1970s, the multiculturalism as an official policy is adopted, and it's most of it taken from the Canadian model rather than the British model of multiracialism. In the long run, it's probably been a good thing, because multiracialism still retains an identity of race, which so your people are still either stigmatized or cast in the term of race. One good thing here is that it's a much looser, as in America they like used to prefer the category ethnic rather than race as such. A bit like gender, sort of having changed from sex to a linguistic trope called gender. The multicultural mandate and the rhetoric changed from erstwhile assimilationist to one of integration. Here the host nation loses its own identity with some modesty, and perhaps so there's a certain characteristic of immigrants' homeland culture coalesced into the new social formation to ease the psychological norm engendered by the alienating, dislocative experience. And so the integration sort of again has that melting pot mentality that America had. On the other hand, it can be a little bit more open, as in the Canadian model, and move towards sort of recognition of heterogeneity rather than homogeneity, in other words, sort of slightly parallel. So here, not all cultural capital, of course, is easily convertible, especially if you have deficiency in English language, overseas qualifications and education. All these things were very, very difficult. They've sort of eased now for various reasons, political reasons mostly. But in those times, they were very hard for people to try and get any of the basic rights, basic religious identity, basic ethnic formations on the table, as it were, as part of a pluralist discussion. It's a lot of fight to sort of have, as Gayatri Spivak says, authentic voice speaking for the others coming up. Of course, what then begins to happen is the immigrants either fight on the land, or they start establishing a closer association with the homeland. So, you know, looking back to the homeland and saying, well, to hell with this place here. We're going to live as though we're back in homeland, what Anderson calls, you know, imagined communities. You have some kind of an idea of what the homeland is all about. And this is now it's about second, third generation people involved in this situation, just as in second, third generation people in Africa. I mean, you probably notice in the immigrant stories that go around and that have been studied, and most of the kids that come here on Wednesday night are actually third, fourth generation from African and East African background. And in some ways, they're a hell of a lot more Hinduized than second generation born from Indian immigrants in Britain, which is a very interesting phenomenon. I happen to be a second generation diasporic, so have some. My mother was actually born in Nairobi, in Kenya, so I have some understanding of that. Okay, and then you have the immigrants sort of shifting between two identities: the identity of looking back home, or the identity of trying to forge a new identity in the country itself. And of course, the latter one will always be compromised. The earlier one will be marked by what we call a tyranny of distance. There's a distance that marking that, and much of it sort of imaginative. You sort of imagine, because things have changed back then, especially after two, three generations. And the one here, you've got the problems that are going on this side, plus the alienation. So you get sort of diasporas, old and new. Here there is a sort of a reconfiguration happens. Religion comes to. It's interesting, yes, you can see it in the case of Gandhi as well, that it's sort of religion somehow turns up to avenge them. I just read recently. I think it might be Tariq Ramadan was saying that 9/11 was sort of really acme of religion getting, you know, involved in politics to kind of make a statement, at least. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, this is why, you know, the interest in Islam has sort of suddenly burgeoned, because, you know, how come Islam got involved in this? Well, precisely this is what happens when people are so oppressed and so forth. It's their religion that comes to the rescue. So the religious worldview brings with it a certain cultural imaginary of difference, however vague, and reinforces a sense of worth of the otherwise maroon and alienated atomist monad that becomes in this process a transnational one becomes in this transnational migration process. So religion and transnationalism go hand in hand to bolster Pathmandu identity, a sense of being both here and there, which comes from the idea of hybridity and so on, which very well exploited.
I'll be back. I don't know why. Because you can't turn it off.
Yeah.
You can't say, don't do it now.
You couldn't postpone it.
It's unbelievable. For we can use Mac. All you need is.
Yeah, we don't have the kit.
I have that.
You have it?
I have it at home. I should have brought that, yes.
I can.
Next time, yeah.
Oh.
How did we live for so long with PCs? Are you a PC user?
No, I got a Mac.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? It just changes the whole world. Look at this. Look at the size of this.
Why is it? What's it doing?
So, I have no idea. It just suddenly decided to shut down. like the Vice Australia policy. So now the third phase is very much. In fact, there is actually no. We've historians have tried to figure out why did they suddenly decide to disband the Vice Australia policy, and of course, historians. We'll argue and we'll look for sort of causal nexus and so forth, just like the Brown and Board of Education judgment in America. They still haven't decided how the Earl Warren, what his name was, Judge Warren, came up with the judgment that he did. People say the pressure came from Soviet Union. I mean, there's this bizarre theories that are circulating, that the pressure came from Soviet Union, that if you don't, you know, tidy up your domestic policies, we'll blow the whistle on you, and on that kind of stuff. White Australia policy, well, it was probably changing sort of the Christian ethos as well towards the other. I mean, they've sort of seen but no, the attitude didn't change towards the Australian Aborigines. And that's the amazing thing about it, is that it all remained very hardened. They were still taking away the children of the Australian Aborigines, assimilating them. There was no votes, no franchise, you know, no welfare, nothing. They were not even recognized as citizens. There had to be a referendum sometime way, way late in like 1968 or sometime. The people were asked, do you think that we should consider the Australian Aborigines as human beings? Citizens, not even citizens, some kind of sort of nationals of the country. Yeah, they had the status of dogs. You could go out and shoot them if you wanted to, yeah. Or rape them, or do whatever you like. It was really of that kind. I mean, much later that they had the sort of recognition. They're not even mentioned in the Australian Constitution. No mention, which is why Ambedkar actually rejected the Australian Constitution as a model, because there's no Dalit. You know, if you don't mention Dalit, then you know, if you don't acknowledge your Dalits, then you're worse than Gandhi, right? Precisely. But it was interesting that of the coloured people. Remember that it was only after the Second World War, after the Holocaust, that the Jews actually got the recognition of being whites. Before that, they were colored people. In South Africa, they were colored people. Apartheid changed it because they needed few more people on their side. So Japanese and Jews became whites in South Africa.
Not Chinese.
Japanese and Jews. Everyone else remained colored. Very interesting. In the States, too, the Jews were actually colored. So they had to, the first fights that they had, the Jews had, was alongside African Americans. They very early on, at some point they switched because there was the recognition that they all came from Europe, even though a lot of them came from Russia or what became Soviet Union. So yes, among the colored. In fact, the Chinese were massacred in Australia in huge numbers in a gold mine in. About at least about 100,000 of them in two separate incidents were maybe I'm exaggerating, maybe there wasn't about 50,000-60,000 were massacred. Yeah, well, not to speak of the Aboriginal, one whole tribe of the very oldest tribe completely wiped out. There was only probably one remaining, and then they caught her. It was a woman, caught her, killed her, and brought her skull here to London. They just retrieved it back. So, you know, it's one of the rare last sort of, you know, if you think in terms of, you know, Darwinian evolutionary sort of specimen and so on, this is one of the oldest racial types that you would find, you know, on Earth. They just wiped them out because they were leftovers from, you know, some evolutionary past. We didn't need them. And of course, all the theorizing that went off, Redcliffe Brown and Fraser and all the anthropologists in the British Royal Societies and so forth, just fueled the you know, Hegel, from beginning with Hegel, of course, that, you know, there's an evolution and people are down here. Or as Kant said, the reason is not yet cooked. It's raw. So you don't need them. Okay, so now we have religion translation go hand in hand, as we said. Now, the Indo-African and Indo-Fijian Hindus and Sikhs never managed to construct grandiose temples. And they had temples, of course, quite large. But the Australian temples, as you'll see in a little while, became very grandiose, became very ambitious. But it didn't start that way. There's a very interesting story of how it started. There was a Sri Lankan couple who were walking around the streets of Sydney, shopping, as in George Street or Corn Market here, and poor guy had a heart attack, and he died, right in front of Mark and Spencer's, the equivalent there. And of course, you know, people didn't know what to do, who these people were, and poor woman said, of course, you know, we need a priest. We need to organize a cremation. Of course, you know, this early 70s, who'd heard of this cremation? You had to actually really make a special request. But, you know, Hindu cremation, she said. And they knew no one. So somehow or other, word got around, and a Hindu priest who used to perform, he was a school teacher, retired, used to perform pujas at people's homes. He turned up and he said, sorry, we don't have a temple. We don't have anything. So what happens when people die? Well, we just call up the funeral people and they take them away. We do the rites and they push them into the furnace. That's about as much as they could do. Well, that wasn't good enough. These were very staunch Hindus. They wanted something a bit better than that. So somehow they managed to round up people after this event and said, well, we really need to do something. And the idea started that, well, perhaps we need a temple. And then so they came about, they bought an old church, a very old dilapidated church, and started to meet regularly. And that church grew into a fairly massive fairly massive organization, not so much a temple yet. But it split into about two groups. So the North Indians and the South Indian went in two different directions. The South Indians, because there were Tamils involved as well, and they're, of course, very good at rallying funding support from the community. The North Indians are slightly less accomplished in that area. But it developed very fast, and within about 3-4 years, they had a temple. But where did they look for their model? They looked for their model. Of course, they were already very well-established Indian academics in universities who would be coming to the States and so on, had a lot of links. And of course, they looked to Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh already had a Sri Venkateshwar temple, and I think there was one going up in Malibu as well. I have a picture of that in California. And those temples became the model. And in fact, there is a lot of exchange of the priests between Malibu and the Sydney temple. And the funding support initially came from the Tirupati Tirumala Devasthanam, the big temple in Andhra. And the statues all came from Mahabalipuram. So, and the silpis came from Chidambaram and nearby Trichy temples in the south. And the blessings and so forth were sent by Kanchipuram gurus and Sringeri gurus. Later on came sort of self-invited, not so much invited, but the guru of the Swami, was Subramania Swami of the Hinduism today in Hawaii. He turned up saying, well, of course, you know, I will inaugurate your temples and so on, because that was funny. That was a very, 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 very interesting incident that had the sort of, he got very angry and stormed out in great protest and tried to curse them and so on. You remember that? You ever met him? Oh, he was quite a character. The first guru, the one who's now, is actually quite decent fellow. He's not bad. He was at some function or somewhere where I was in LA. And there's a picture of him. No, he was a really really tough guy. He got into fight with Dafri John.
Did he?
Well, Dafri John had a temple, had his ashram right next to this, and you can imagine, you could just sort of walk past and you could smell everything, you know. From that temple, of course, from dope to, you know, so.
On the same island, the Shaiva
same neighborhood, same neighborhood, and there was this parties and wild stuff going on, and these people are, you know, sort of trying to live a good, decent, clean, pure, sexless life. Yes, I mean, the Dafri John was quite a character. Do you know he died? He was supposed to, you know, because he was supposed to take sitting samadhi, you know, like this Guru Muktananda. And of course, they you know, banked his body and prayed him that he took Mahasamadhi, nothing like that at all. He apparently died with a woman next to him. This is where he spent most of his time, it seems. Anyway, okay. Hang on. All right. Here we have a grand, the process of the grand temple coming up. Oh, this can't be the end here. Here we are. All right. Some Australian European backers are also willing to try some Eastern religious practices, the well-being and security. Ask about 150 Australian in some detail about their religious and spiritual practice. Almost 1 in 5 said that in the last 12 months they've practiced yoga, tai chi. So this is sort of part of the sort of globalization of religion has met the spread of religions that were previously confined. So you then have in the 60s and so on, you think of, you know, yoga, Swamis, Sai Babas, Muktananda, Vedanta, Rajneesh, Ishkon. I like the, you know, Deepak Chopra opera and TM meditation. Yeah, well, sort of opera's identity got merged with Deepak Chopra, I think. What else? Now, Hindus in the Australian community is a high level of education and very specialized occupation that most Hindus have. In 2006, the Hindu community was more highly educated than any other religious community, with 51% of all Hindus 15 years and older having university degrees. Multi-faith councils and conversations that have evolved. People of other faiths have found it easy to dialogue with Hindus, like the World Parliament of Religions held in Melbourne in 2000. The evangelism of Hindu and Sikh diasporic presence from North America and UK was quite pronounced. Interestingly, the sort of the local Hindus were sort of almost demure, very quiet. That sort of the loud noises came from from the Hindus in America, like the Hindu Foundation. Why haven't you had a textbook problem in Australia, they said. Let's create one. Well, that's because my book is the only one that's used. And no one can debate, no one can argue with that. In a world of uncertainty, fundamentally it's the attitudes in which one decides what is a particular religious thought is exclusively correct. Correct to some people generally look with suspicion to the majority. Now, this is just odd bits and pieces picked up from the sort of theoretical chapters that I wrote. One of the theoretical chapters on transnationalism, I think, was published in Religious Compass. So it's grown out from that. I think I might just sort of skip some of this more sort of theoretical discussions and get to some of the pictures and show you. In the background is the long and rich tradition, heritage and culture of the native or Aboriginal people struggling to survive. Sadly, there isn't much interaction of these new religions with indigenous Aboriginal communities. This lag does not hold much promise towards a fusion of discordant horizons to produce a new tradition. But that's what we might call the post-secular modernity. This is something that I'm writing on at the moment. It's critically tolerant, morally more enlightened, artistic, and truly democratic, which is not what's actually happening at the moment. This is something else I would like to see. So we're still very much in kind of a modernist phase where people are trying to be modern, even though they are trying to retain their religions and so on and so forth. But it's much more a local affair for them. It is local, but on the other hand, they are making inroads into certain hierarchies within the established society. So now there is, Deepavali is sort of almost being recognized as a bit like Jewish New Year or Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur. The city of Melbourne and Sydney sort of open up the whole town for parades of Indian students to come and gather, have a bit of firework and just enjoy themselves. Holi also, they're sort of recognized. And universities also provide space for this. So Diwali is sort of becoming very interestingly integrated as one of the holidays. One of the city councils actually has a beautiful statue of Ganesh, which they got hold of, and they allow a procession of the Ganesh once a year, and they have I will show you in a minute. They make a surrogate, well, it's a Utsav Murti of Ganesh with clay, and that is actually then immersed in the local river as well. It's the only pollution that's ever allowed. Australia is a very clean place. It's amazingly clean. It's wonderful. It's actually paraded not only on the road but also on the tram, like the trolley bus we have. It's actually paraded in that part on a tram. So there are local people getting out. What's this? And then someone tells them that this is the Shire councils, like the Oxford Shire, you can imagine, has adopted Ganesh as the sort of patron deity of that suburb. These are all people there are sort of Maltese and Lebanese and all Australians, as we call them. I didn't know that there were that many Hindus, but obviously it's somehow taken a fascination somewhere. So it's interesting, and number of temples are going up. I should mention that, in fact, in Melbourne, the oldest Hindu temple is the ISKCON temple. That was established when Srila Prabhupada came, before, I think he came in like 1972, if I'm not wrong. I think so. And then by 1975, the temple was established. And then came, I think I might get onto the pictures, actually, the other one, because I don't think there is anything. Let me see. What's this one? That was the last one, right? Yeah. So I can now tell some stories through pictures. So the situation now, at the present time, right? Okay. At the present time, the situation is that there is a considerable population of Hindus and Sikhs in Australia. Hinduism is the largest growing religion, not because of conversion or heavy immigration as such. By immigration, we mean people who are sort of migrating and permanently settling. This is actually as a result of one might call temporary migration. What's happening is that there's a shortage of labor in Australia. The Anglo-Celtic, probably the best way to put it, is the Anglo-Celtic European. People of Anglo-Celtic European stock declining. In fact, they're declining by what is it? If four people are dying a year, only two are being born. So how would you? It's by 50% almost, yeah, something like that. Two or three are born. Say two are born and one comes in as an immigrant from Britain, Ireland, or somewhere. So you're losing 10% a year. That's right. They're declining by 10% a year, and so they depend on new immigrants for all kinds of stuff, running 7-Elevens, running taxis. The same here in Oxford too, in some ways. There's a taxi rank in Sydney called the PhD, Sikh PhD, or Punjab University PhD taxi rank. Well, what had happened was a university, agricultural university, was closing down. Something was happening. A whole lot of them got the whole almost the entire faculty got job in an agricultural college in Sydney. But by the time they arrived, that closed down as well. So they were all on the street driving taxis. That's where the PhD taxi rank. I like that. I've gone up to Sydney and I'm on the PhD taxi. Voila. And of course, when I sat down, he drove me around Sydney for free. He was so happy to meet another professor who actually had a job, a real job. We have something like maybe about 250,000 Hindus and sort of Sikhs mixed together, which is a high number for Australia, given that, you know, it's only 21 million people in the entire country. And as you saw, in terms of education, among the ethnic groups, they're the highest educated, least problematic in terms of marriage and so on, although there are domestic problems that don't always come to light. The second generation go on, as they do here and in the States, to do medicine, higher professional degrees and so forth. In terms of marriage and so forth, arranged marriage still goes on to some extent, but there is transnational marriages now, so Indian kids in Australia would look for a partner in Britain or in the States if the pressure from the parents were to sort of marry another Indian. So that goes on too. But the biggest sort of focus and activity at the moment is not in education. Education is a sort of more family kind of thing, but in terms of culture and community, is building temples. And so here is the oldest Hindu temple, and this, you know, started with the man who died outside Mark and Spencer. So, you know, it's his wife's wish that I wish there was a temple where I could go and offer and ask for blessings and so forth, and that's how it came about. And it's a magnificent temple. In one of the books, I spent quite a bit of time discussing this. A beautiful gopuram. The slides have got a bit mixed up. So here is the festival of Ganesh. This one is because of families, but something similar I described that happens in Melbourne with the parade on the trolley and so on. So it's become a widespread thing. And then the Bengalis, of course, they do the Durga as well, but that's much more private. This is another temple, Parramatha Hindu temple, and I think it's a Murugan temple. Yeah, it is a Murugan temple. And that's there's yet another one. This is out in Dubois. Out in the country, right? Really in the country area. It's a small temple. It's mostly somehow other Malaysian Hindus, because it looks like a Malaysian Hindu temple too. This I cannot remember which Gopuram this is. There's a Nataraj there, so it's probably a Surya Subramanya, the one I showed a little earlier, the Murugan temple. This is Abhisheka on one of the temples in New South Wales. It's a smaller temple. This is the headquarters or the ashram of the Siddha Yoga, which Muktananda founded when he came to Australia with... Who came with him? Was it Alan Watts or... Someone very famous came with him in 1968. Just trying to figure out who it was. No, I don't think it was Alan Watts. It was someone else that they was associating themselves with. But it's thriving and it's very well run. This is a private home. The point is not so much that there is an image of Sai Baba there, which is true, but there is a dog included as well. You know, very attentively. I think I like that. That's my cousin family. This is the Sydney Temple. It grew with the one at the back, and you'll see another image of that. That's the Venkateshwar Temple proper, and that was the Vishnu. The one in the front is a later addition, which is the Shiva part. So, what you have much more ecumenical. You'd barely get away with this in Chidambaram, I think, right? You'd just about get away with having a Shiva Vishnu, but nothing, no part of the building should touch the Shaivite and Vishnavite. In Melbourne, it's actually very different. You have a whole hall, and the shrines are inside the hall, and you have Venkateshwar, you have Devi, Venkateshwar, Ganesh, I think. The Devis are on site, and then just here you have Shivalingam. So you have Venkateshwar and Shivalingam and Vishalakshi and Ganesh, all in one. This is quite amazing. And I'll show you in a minute. Even Ayyappan gets involved in this too. Now that's this Venkateshwar temple that we just saw. This is the Shiva part. This is a little temple in Sydney. Was fired at recently, which was very sad. No one claimed responsibility, but apparently some masked man was seen. Sprayed bullet, no one got injured and so on, but it may have been part of the sort of a bit of a racist backlash that has happened against Indian students. I think you might have read about that. I think they became too prominent and too visible, and you've always had the last generation, the last immigrant group feel threatened by the next one, so they go for each other a little bit, but it's calmed down now. Unfortunately, this hasn't come out too well. But this is inside the Melbourne Temple, not even outside. This is inside. So you have an utsava, you have a platform, and then a low floor, so they can actually take the murti all the way around and then stop on it and establish it in a corner. Which means they don't even have to go outside of the temple. It all happens inside, and there would be various different shrines. This is another temple, a Hindu temple in Perth, a very beautiful temple. And most of them you can see either have a small gopuram or a large gopuram, but at least something is always going on around and inside. This is the Shiva Vishnu temple in Melbourne. So you have a gopuram each for for Shiva and for Vishnu, but there's Devi inside there as well, so it is called Shiva Vishnu Devi Temple. This was the there was one wonderful architecture actually. It's an image I had taken. The back part of the Venkateshwar Temple, so the main shikara is of the of Vishnu, and then the his two Andal and what's the other Lakshmi of I think it's Tirumala, the Andal and not it's not pretty much he has two consorts when Venkateshwar. And as I said, you know, the model for some of the temple have come from the temples in the US, and this is the Hindu temple in Malibu, California. Prabhupada Bhaktivedanta Swami. He was sitting there in 1972. Is that what it is, do you think?
Probably.
It's actually a statue. Isn't that amazing? It's one of the uncanny rare ones that you see. You sort of you walk into there and you look around and you think there's a guy sitting there. It's so real. How do they do it? I had a debate with him when he was sitting on that very gadda, and way back in the early days when I visited, I almost got thrown out. Of the place, and a nice young devotee came and gave me some water and sweet because she saw how distressed I was, and I said, "You'll come and study with me, won't you?" And years later, she came back. 10 years she came, and she's the one who's written the PhD on the Hare Krishna movement in Australia and New Zealand. So something good came out of that fight. But I got to know the cook, the chef, Kurma. And he would invite me to his Gopal restaurant sometimes. He ran a little kitchen. He's very well known, actually. He's got television and books and so forth. Hmm? Yeah. This is the Hinduism Today Guru at a puja during the World Parliament of Religion in Melbourne. And that's him there. They had all the religions had little rooms where they could do their prayers. It hasn't come out too well, but this is Ayyappan in Melbourne. I was doing a paper, I think it was last year or year before last, at the AAR, and I had known nothing about Ayyappan at all. I didn't know who he was really. I mean, I had some idea because there are a lot of Ayyappans in India that you see them clad in black. I was surprised to find that there's actually a whole statue of Ayyappan in a temple in Melbourne, and the only other place outside of India that there is any significant presence of that is in Minnesota. There is a big statue of him in one of the temples there too, but not much else, not anywhere else. Yeah, he's one of those that funny mix of a yogi, man, woman, you know, sort of quite a mix. Very interesting. When I actually did some work on Ayyappan, I found it to be a very, very curiously sort of brings together at a certain time with certain political currents that were coming together, including Dalit elements and Muslim as well. There is a Muslim a little sort of almost like a mosque right next to where he is, and you actually have to go and give some money to the Muslim guy before you go into this temple. It's interesting. This was the Gurudwara that I talked about. Very old, like 1930s. This is the early Sikhs. It's interesting that there was a presence already marked on the land by the Sikhs that early, and now more Gurudwaras have come up and they have grown. This is a Gurudwara in Melbourne. Where they're having a langar, which is really food on Sundays or some other days too. This is the projected Swaminarayan temple in Melbourne. Of course, like all Swaminarayan temples, it's going to be huge. I had never met a Swaminarayan follower in Melbourne. never heard of their presence in Melbourne. Next thing you hear, they've got this huge big land and they're going to put up this huge big temple. And I still don't know where their followers are coming from, or whether they just have so much money that they decide they're just going to go plant a temple there, and then the Hindus will start coming. I think that's basically the idea. Yeah, just grandiose. I mean, it'll eclipse. Unfortunately, it will eclipse the sort of really more culturally based, locally grown, you know, really people's own sweat that build those temples that we saw from tin sheds. And this is really Coca-Cola kind of, you know, phenomenon, which I'm a bit weary of, really. And it'll become the tourist attraction and so on. Oh, I couldn't resist this one, yeah. I took this in the Himalayas, yeah. I mean, this is real Hinduism. The temple inside, right? Okay. All right. That's about all, you know, in terms of a presentation that I wanted to make, and maybe we could have some discussions.